Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we're marking a century since the deadliest tornado to strike the U.S., and it happened in southeast Missouri, southern Illinois, and southern Indiana. It was known as the Tri-State Tornado. We'll talk about it and hear stories of some of the survivors. Also, something that's been a problem in schools since the pandemic, chronic absences. The number is less than what it was in the early days of COVID, but still far higher than before. We'll also get reaction to major cuts to the U.S. Department of Education announced this week and what that could mean at the local level. And in higher education, there's a lot of uncertainty, including for PhD students, we'll explain. Small-town grocery stores play a key role in those communities, but many are finding it hard to stay in business. And calling it quits, we'll hear from an attorney about some trends in divorces. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This month marks the 100th anniversary of what has become known as the Tri-State Tornado. As its name implies, the storm began in southeast Missouri, moved through southern Illinois, and on to southern Indiana. It's been widely studied as the deadliest tornado in U.S. history, killing nearly 700 people, injuring more than 2,000. Angela Mason became fascinated with the Tri-State Tornado in the early 1980s. She wrote a piece for a local newspaper where she worked, but in the late 1990s, she began traveling throughout the area, interviewing survivors of that storm, many who were just children at the time. Those firsthand accounts are the basis for her book, Death Rides the Sky, and she talked to us about what she learned. What was the day like for people when this storm moved through? Was there any evidence that severe weather was possibly on its way?
No, to a person, and I interviewed 54 survivors, to a person, they were all saying the only thing that was a standout about that day was that it was warm. March 18th, you know, right before spring, some of the folks that I spoke with, they had parents that were very weather-wise farmers. And the farmers said, you know, the air felt close and muggy. And that generally was a warning that they might get storms, but they had no idea the magnitude of what was coming out.
And of course, we did not have the warning systems that we have today.
Where it dropped in Missouri, what they saw around them basically were mountains and trees. See, it was the foothills of the Ozarks. So you really couldn't tell what was coming up unless it was right overhead, right on top of you. And I've been out there and they're absolutely right. If you're in the hills and hollers, you can't see what's happening. So it dropped there in Ellington at what is believed to be an EF3 and then moved on through there. So these folks could kind of feel there was a change in the atmosphere as it got closer, but they didn't know what was happening until it was right on them.
Now, it's called a Tri-State Tornado. It has been historically, but is it clear if it was one tornado? It's most likely, from what I've read, possibly different tornadoes that were formed?
My weather guys that I interviewed, including the late Chuck Doswell, who's just a weather genius, in my opinion, he believed the reports that from the individuals in there and in my book that indicated that there were three vortices within one big vortex. So imagine one great big giant tornado rotating. And within that rotation, there are three other smaller tornadoes rotating. He has all kinds of speculation as to how that could happen. But the survey tracks and the eyewitness reports indicate such a thing. Now, they didn't see three tornadoes until Griffin, Indiana. But a lot of my little old ladies, I want to call them because it was all of them, that were pointing out, and they each said something different about how it felt when it moved over. They would say the air got close three times. Or one of the ladies said it was like whoosh, 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 and then it was gone. So they described this three gust phenomenon.
Let's talk about the people that you did speak with who witnessed this tornado. Some were very young at the time, and probably, you know, had some memory of it, but I think you said, you told me before, maybe got a lot of the gaps filled in from their parents and others through the years. But others were more aware. They were late teens, 20 years old when this happened, and you spoke with these people. Give us a few of the stories that really stood out to you.
I would have to say the singular story that still gets to me, and it's difficult even for me to talk about, and that came out of DeSoto, which is in Jackson County, outside of Murfreesboro. And that would be Lala Bridges. Her name was Lillian Buller. Her little sisters called her Lala, so I call her Lala. And she was 16 at the time. Her mother was going to watch a neighbor woman who was about to give birth. I guess her mother was kind of like a midwife. And Lala being 16, and then her little sister Lola, and then her baby sister Ruby, who was only 3 months old, were all going over to this gal's house for the baby's birth. And the storm was approaching. Lala's uncle, his name was Sam, worked over in the rail there in DeSoto. She's not sure if the rail house in Murfreesboro was able to get a telegram over to Sam, or if he just saw that cloud coming up on the hill, but he went running down the street yelling, and he pounded on the door there at Lala's house, and he said, if you get to Grandma Tippy's basement right now, you're probably going to make it through this, but you need to go right now. And Lala's mom said, no, I can't. I have to help with this baby. And so he was running up and down the street telling everybody, well, here came the tornado. And Lala was holding on to her baby sister. And the tornado pulled her out of the front window of this house and above the trees. And I asked her, what did you see when you were up there? And she said, I'm not really sure. She said it was just trees whipping back and forth below me. And then she lost the baby. She lost hold of the baby and went crashing down into the street. That just, I had a three-year-old child at the time. Most of that chapter was written with her on my lap. It was just heartbreaking.
I'm guessing a lot of folks had similar remembrances of this, that they, maybe even some of their first memories.
It's possible. I don't know that anybody ever told me that, but yeah, that's a very strong possibility. And the thing about it is, every story that I chose, there was some element of it that was like Lala's. It was just so tragic. And you could hear it in their voice. You could see it in their eyes. They were reliving it. And this is something that I later learned, really, because when I was 19 and I said, why hasn't anybody ever written a lot about this story? Well, those folks didn't want to talk. We're talking 50 years hence, they still didn't want to talk. They were traumatized. And by the time I came around in 1999 and 2000 and 2001, almost every other one would say, I'm at the end of my life. I might as well talk to you about it. And so we would sit for hours and have coffee or tea, and I would hold their hands. They got it out. They got the story out. And some of them even said, well, you got this out of me. I hadn't talked to anybody about this in so long, or maybe even ever. That was kind of a success. It's kind of an odd success, but it was, to get these folks to talk about it, because they were so traumatized.
Did they seem to have, and I've seen this happen in other situations with bad storms, they get a fear of storms. Did you notice that from those folks, that they were fearful of any time a dark cloud came on the horizon, that would be something that followed them the rest of their life?
Absolutely. Mary Bell Melvin, one of the most lovely ladies I've ever met over in Murfreesboro, you'd look at her and you would think, oh, she's so polished and refined and she's just so neat. But when a dark cloud came up, she would just kind of lose it. She said, I would just kind of go into a trance. She was so traumatized. She was the one who told me that from the fires in Murfreesboro, after the tornado came, a second disaster came, a second wave of disaster, which were the fires And she said, I can still hear those screams of people dying in the fires. And it happened all night, overnight, the 18th into the 19th. They weren't very far away from the fires. And she could hear them as an eight-year-old child. When a bad storm would blow up, she would just almost freeze. There was one that came through Murfreesboro in 1957, almost on the exact same track. Her daughter was with her at the time, and her daughter actually had to physically take her hand and lead her downstairs into the basement so they could be safe in case that tornado came anywhere near her. So yes, it was a lifetime for these people.
I know that there have been storms in the past that have damaged schools, students at the schools, you know, very concerned community after something like that happens. That happened in this storm as well. The kids were in school, and it hit more than one of them, right?
Yeah, it seemed like the little schoolhouses and also the big schoolhouses. There was a three-story one in DeSoto that was new. It was maybe 10 years old. It seemed like they were magnets. And over in Missouri, even too, little one-room schoolhouses got it. But you have to think about how many one-room schoolhouses were actually on the landscape at the time. There were a lot of them. These children, many of them were harmed in the collapse of their schools. In Gorham, in Murfreesboro, in DeSoto, in Parrish, there were a lot of injuries.
How did the towns recover, or did some fail to recover after this storm?
Some did not. I can tell you that Parrish is just like a grouping of houses now, whereas it used to be a viable town, post office, store, feed mill, that kind of thing. There were buildings there in 1999 when I went to find survivors that have since been torn down, but they were ancient buildings. A lot of them were sway back. But Murfreesboro is one of the saddest stories because they were an up and coming place. They had a lot of industry at the time, and they were really set to be a wonderful, big, moving economy there. And the tornado took that out. It took out the GM&O roundhouse where they worked on the rail cars. They decided not to relocate or, you know, rebuild there. They relocated elsewhere. So it wrecked Murfreesboro economy at the time, did a lot of damage to West Frankfort because the mines. This storm was so vicious and the winds so massive that it rolled full coal cars, just rolled them and wrecked the tipples, wrecked so much mining equipment at Orient outside of West Frankfort. They did rebuild, but you have to think about what that was doing to the immediate economy there. It wasn't farm season yet. It was coming up. People were planting. But there was a lot of economic problems that stemmed from this.
This would have been a damaging tornado. You just alluded to its strength. Even if the warning systems we have today were in place, this would have been unthinkable damage. However, the loss of life, I'm assuming people think now that if we had more warning and give people more advanced knowledge that this was coming, could have saved hundreds of lives from this storm.
I believe so. There's been a lot of speculation about that. Because of the number of school children that were in the buildings that couldn't withstand that kind of blow, there were so many child deaths. In DeSoto, of the 69 dead, 38 were children. So if there had been any kind of warning system, they could have taken cover. As it was, many of them were actually caught outside. They were just caught unawares, you know. They were children. You see big black clouds rolling up and you think, oh, it's going to rain. They didn't even call it a tornado back then. They called it a cyclone. And some of those children didn't even know what that was. As far as the tales from the adults, from the people who were adults at the time or teenagers, they were cognizant of the fact that there wasn't any kind of warning system. They told me if we just had something, if we had known that day was going to be maybe a negative type of weather day, maybe kind of potentially dangerous situation, but they really didn't have that. They didn't have the kind of forecasting we have now, and they had no early alert systems at all.
So as somebody who's studied this, who's interviewed survivors. What do you think the lesson is from the tri-state tornado?
I've been asked that a lot. There are several, but I think the most important would be prepared. My children were very young when I was going through the interview process and we were driving all over three states. They went with me. They heard the stories too. And they were kind of scared. And I'm like, we don't need to be scared. We have a basement. Let's have a plan. So we would actually practice tornado drills. And sure enough, we had one go right like down our street that same year. And everything went fine. The kids got in the basement. They even had a hold of the cat. They were ready to go and they were not scared. And that's a big thing. You cannot prepare in fear. You have to prepare when things are calm and when you can think rationally. So I think that's probably the biggest takeaway from the book. But the other thing that I want people to know is that history does die. As your older senior citizens, as they die off, their stories are dying with them. If they didn't write them down, nobody else did, they're gone. What can we learn from our elders? This is something that we really put a lot of effort into this book, is that we want people to know everybody's story is important. I tell people, we could probably write a book about every single person, every single one that went through this storm. You have to kind of filter it down when you're going for publication, but these people are valid. They have stories. They went through something that hopefully will never happen again. We need to preserve those stories, but also know the kind of spirit that it takes to come back.
Angela Mason is author of Death Rides the Sky. It features the stories of survivors from the tri-state tornado. The deadly storm moved through southeast Missouri, onto southern Illinois, and then southern Indiana, and is considered the deadliest tornado in U.S. history. She's part of events taking place to commemorate the 100th anniversary of that storm on March 18, 1925. We've got more to come on Statewide. Stay right here. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. It's hard enough being a PhD student in normal times. There are long hours, skimpy paychecks, and constant pressure to publish. But now young researchers are up against what feels like an insurmountable roadblock, the uncertainty and instability of federal research funding under President Trump. Lisa Kurian Phillip has more.
Brittany Smart is sitting in a sun-filled classroom getting ready for a nearly four-hour lecture on maternal health. She's in her first year as a PhD student at University of Illinois Chicago School of Public Health.
My entry into this work was really about, like, why do we see the inequities that we do for Black birthing people specifically, like being three times more likely to die? Like, no one should have to, like, think about, am I going to die having a baby in this country?
When I ask Smart how the past few weeks have been since Trump took office, she says tough twice. The president has upended federal research funding and is specifically targeting research related to equity. That has felt like an attack on what Smart hopes will be her life's work, trying to keep Black women safe during childbirth.
Public health is under attack. Like maternal and child health is under attack, and it feels like particularly insidious how the infrastructure we've developed is being like stripped for parts.
The chaos of the Trump administration is hitting researchers like Smart, who are just starting their careers, especially hard. They're unsure of whether or not federal grants will exist to support their work. Smart relies on a National Science Foundation fellowship to fund her PhD. And the agency has started flagging keywords as simple as diversity and women.
I'm interested specifically in racism and the impact of racism on Black birthing people. And racism is one of the words, right, that we're not supposed to be using anymore. Like, I don't know if that's funding that I have anymore, right? So that's like, it's like the lack of knowing, I think, is also particularly distressing.
And it's hard to plan for. Some universities have paused graduate school admissions because they don't know if they'll have funding to take on new students. Or they've taken down job postings for early career researchers because ditto on the funding. Maggie Butler is a postdoc at UIC School of Public Health.
I'm looking for the next thing, and I've seen positions that were available the week before, and then you go back to like open the application and the position's gone. It's just a 404 page.
Butler and her colleagues worry about their own careers, but they're even more concerned about the communities they serve. Minji King Ha is in her fifth and hopefully final year as a PhD student. Her research centers on making sure marginalized women have access and a say in their health care.
We have such a long, really sordid history when it comes to reproductive health, especially for these minority populations, forced sterilizations, forced births, the whole range of awful coercive practices translate today. Because, yeah, maybe we're not forcing sterilization among populations, but we are coercing them to take, you know, use an IUD.
Kang Ha says addressing this mistreatment requires research.
We are trying to find the gaps in order to help people reach this equitable level of health, you know? And so it's hard with an administration that is so focused on removing that. It takes away a lot of our ability to do what we need to do in order to help communities. And so that feels just as overwhelming and defeating.
Kang Ha is committed to a career in research, but she wouldn't be surprised if others opt out entirely.
I would hope that it empowers people more to work harder and fight harder, but I don't blame people if they feel defeated and don't want to get into this field. What is propelling people to want to do this work if they're going to be stopped at every corner?
Kang Ha worries the country could lose out on a generation of researchers as a result. Lisa Corian Phillip, WBEZ News.
The Trump administration this week announcing major cuts to the U.S. Department of Education. Peter Medland spoke with Al Lawrence about the impact on Illinois schools. He's president of the Illinois Education Association, the state's largest teachers union.
A lot of people don't understand how the federal Department of Education functions in relation to their schools. You've said that these layoffs could have a profound impact on Illinois schools. How do you think families, students, teachers could see the impacts of these cuts locally?
First of all, 80% of our public schools in Illinois are underfunded. There's also a teacher and educator shortage across the board. I've been in schools in Decatur where there were three certified teachers. Everyone else was a full-time sub. And that had been going on for 2 or 3 years. So if you cut funding to an already underfunded system, I think there's going to be a loss of the quality of education for a lot of those students. So in the long run, what it's going to mean is I don't think any of those students will achieve what they could have achieved had they gotten all the accommodations they needed in the first place, because they dried up the funds.
Illinois schools, on average, rely on the federal government for about 12% of their revenue. It's much higher at some low-income schools, and that's thanks to programs like Title I, which provides funding to low-income schools, and IDEA, which helps fund special education services. The new Department of Education director has tried to say that people shouldn't worry about those programs and funding streams going away, that they'll still be funded by Congress even if the Department of Education's eliminated. At this point, how concerned are you about federal funding for Title I and IDEA going away?
Let me put it to you like this. It's been the forefront of what's in my mind for the last several days, and probably a little bit longer than that. Back in, I believe it was 1969 or 70, there wasn't a Department of Ed yet, and things were held at the state in terms of accountability, and they weren't doing a good job then. The Department of Education is a centralized place that can do accountability and enforcement on all these programs. It wasn't working before the department, and I don't think that once the department is eliminated, it's going to work again.
That's something important to note, that programs like Title I did exist before the Department of Education existed, like you just mentioned. You know, some conservatives in education say they want states and schools to have more flexibility in how they can spend that federal funding, and that this is a way to start doing that. Do you think that they have a point on that?
All children should have the best opportunity that they can get to get a great public education. I do not believe that once there's no enforcement that all of those things will be in place.
One of the Department of Education's other roles is investigating potential civil rights violations. There's reporting today from the folks over at Chalkbeat that the entire Office of Civil Rights team based in Chicago was let go. What impact do you think that that could have?
Well, if you start talking about compliance, in a perfect world, everyone would always do what they're supposed to do. In reality, we have a situation where not everybody gets equal treatment for one reason or another because of the color of their skin, whether they're physically impaired. Kids don't always get what they need. Case in point, public schools don't turn away anyone that comes to the door. Private schools cherry pick who they want to allow in. And so if we send money to those private schools that don't allow every student, certainly we're not going to have a greater scope of impact. We're going to have a lesser scope of impact on doing the best for kids.
Is there anything else about this whole issue about the Department of Education that you just think is more important than people might realize?
If there was no money to be had in public education, I don't think there would be any fervor for people to privatize public education. And so if you look at the people that are actually going to profit from this, would they be that concerned if there was no money here? I would offer to you that I think the answer is absolutely not. Is this for the kids? Answer, no.
That's Al Lawrence, president of the Illinois Education Association. He spoke with Peter Medlin about the local impact of cuts to the Department of Education. And now Peter brings us a story on the percentage of Illinois students who are chronically absent. That means they miss more than 10% of the school year. That number skyrocketed during the early pandemic. It's fallen a bit since, but rates are still far higher than pre-COVID. Here's that report.
Sonia Navarro's asking students where they're supposed to be while walking down the hallway at Constance Lane Elementary School in Rockford. It's her job to make sure kids are getting to class. It's her first year as an attendance specialist. This year, for the first time, every Rockford school has one. So as much time as she spends with the kids, getting students to school means working with their parents and helping them understand how attendance affects their child's success.
When a child has such poor attendance, it makes it difficult to provide them the interventions and the resources here because of attendance.
Navarro calls it a snowball effect. Kids miss school, they fall behind on assignments, they get frustrated, they start acting out, and then they don't want to come to school. And it can be difficult to break that cycle, but she says helping students often starts with helping their parents. They've got a Google map that shows all the community resources in the area, like laundromats and food pantries. They can get some families gas cards, but for most parents, she says the biggest challenge is transportation.
They're working 2 to 3 jobs, and those hours between getting them on the bus or getting them to school, I mean, the job is the priority, which I as a parent can understand that.
So they've started a tutoring program before school, which provides transportation. So far, they've had over 100 students get involved, and they've connected families with after-school programs, which she says has helped a lot too. And of course, she also tries to motivate her students.
If we're tardy all the time, how about we try to get on that bus so we're not tardy? We'll work that week. We could try to do, you know, a McDonald's if they like McDonald's.
It seems to be working. RPS Chief of Schools Morgan Gallagher says they've seen chronic absence rates fall significantly across the district, and particularly at elementary schools.
Constance Lane went from this time last year being 48% to 21% as of this week.
It's a bit more complicated at the high schools, where attendance can be less within a parent's control. Back in 2022, at its worst, about 60% of RPS students were chronically absent. They cut it down to 46% last year, but it's still persistently higher than pre-COVID levels. Gallagher says that impacts academic achievement too.
We're making the right gains, but chronic absenteeism is the ceiling.
You can only improve graduation rates or literacy levels so much if a large portion of the district is chronically not going to school. And this is not just a Rockford problem. At all kinds of districts, chronic absenteeism has settled from those highest COVID peaks to a new normal that's still much higher than before. Where Rockford has 27,000 students, the Stewart Elementary School District has 56. Nearly 20% of those students were chronically absent last year, where in 2018, it was under 2%. Now, either way, with a school that small, those changes represent just a few students, and their solutions are likely going to be much different than in a district like Rockford. Steven Simpson is the superintendent, and he feels like part of it is that families are just choosing to keep their kids at home longer when they're sick, but that's not all. As COVID-era upheaval caused stress and anxiety for many teachers and students, they adopted a social-emotional learning curriculum for the first time in the district's history.
We wanted to give faculty and our students a common language for talking about relational issues, conflict, conflict resolution.
He hopes it'll make school feel more welcoming so students are less likely to avoid it. Steve Wilder is the superintendent at Sycamore, a middle-sized district between Stewart and Rockford, and he says they've committed to mental health support as well, and that the pandemic opened their eyes to the real anxiety many of their students face. Wilder says even though they're on the right track, chronic absenteeism is not a problem that's going to go away anytime soon.
My gut is that that drop, that decline might take a little bit longer than we'd like to. You know, it might be much more gradual, but I don't know that we'll ever get back to the rates that we were at pre-COVID.
Back at Constance Lane, Navarro says they're taking more time to show families they can help and also connect with them in fun ways. She says they just held a family dance for Valentine's Day, complete with pizza and a DJ. And schools everywhere will keep trying to convey the importance of attendance and how if you're not in school, it makes it pretty hard to learn. I'm Peter Medlin.
At institutions around the world, there are special libraries that contain millions of plants. They're called herbaria. As scientists work to understand and adapt to climate change, these plant collections have become even more important. But in some places, their future is in question. Harvest Public Media's Kate Grumke reports on why scientists want you to care about herbaria.
Matthew Austin twists a huge gear at the end of a large gray library stack style shelf in a room filled with many more just like it. This is the herbarium at the Missouri Botanical Garden in St. Louis. It's one of the largest collections of dried plant specimens in the world. The tall compactors slide open, revealing shelves on either side filled with hundreds of manila folders.
Okay, Sanguinaria canadensis.
Austin flips through pages with dried plants stuck to them and reads the labels.
One with no flowers from March 24th, 1935. One with flowers from March 22nd, 1894.
Austin is a curator of biodiversity data here. Like many scientists, he knows that climate change is affecting when flowers bloom, sometimes throwing them off by weeks.
We know that flowering is highly controlled by temperature. The herbarium struck me as a really powerful tool to addressing this.
The changes Austin found are something that other scientists are finding in herbaria elsewhere. They say these plant libraries are essential for understanding the crises the planet faces, like biodiversity loss and climate change. But many are worried about the health of these institutions. Early last year, an announcement sent waves through the botany community. Duke University planned to get rid of its herbarium. Kathleen Pryor is its director.
I was called into the dean's office and told the herbarium was dead.
There was a real uproar from the scientific community. Scientists condemned the decision in journals. More than 20,000 signatures on a change.org petition asked the university to reconsider.
The outrage was very remarkable, and I think it stunned the Duke administration into silence.
A year later, Pryor says it's still not clear what's going to happen. The news was a warning shot heard throughout the herbaria community, says Barbara Tears, director emerita of the New York Botanical Garden Herbarium. Tears tracks the number of herbaria around the world. Overall, they're doing okay. But she says it's shocking that an herbarium as big as Duke is on the chopping block.
It felt like a slap in the face at a time when we are all trying so hard to document biodiversity and to understand it as we face the environmental challenges that we're facing.
Tears says each collection is vulnerable to the whims of its institution. At a time when federal funding for education and research is in question, she's worried.
I feel like we're always just on the brink of disaster, of major herbaria closing, but fortunately it hasn't happened yet.
Smaller herbaria have closed, and the orphaned plants had to be taken in by other collections. Lynn Clark is the director of Iowa State University's herbarium, which has grown in recent decades. About 20 years ago, it took in the University of Iowa's collection.
So we grew 50% kind of overnight.
Then in the last 2 years, they got the University of Northern Iowa's herbarium.
It's important to make sure that all of these are taken care of. Not that we like to see Herbaria closing, but we can't just let them be mothballed either.
At Herbaria across the country, scientists are racing to digitize all of this information so they can learn about the ecosystems we might lose before it's too late. I'm Kate Grumke, Harvest Public Media.
The trends in divorces, that story and more still to come on Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A Chicago-area divorce attorney, Rayford Dalton Palmer, is author of the bestseller, I Just Want This Done, and a similarly named podcast about dating and divorce. He spoke with our Maureen McKinney about trends in marriage splits, including a growing number of gray or senior divorces.
One of the topics is gray divorce.
It's a significant issue, definitely these days demographically, and a trend in terms of divorce filings. And the folks that seek us out as clients, we see an increasing trend in our divorce firm. And we want to make sure we're addressing the concerns of those people who I think have traditionally been underserved and underinformed. The traditional divorce lawyer market or business is aiming at people 35 to 45 years old. There are a lot of people out there getting divorced in their late 50s and 60s and older who have somewhat different concerns and issues, and that isn't being addressed very well.
Why not?
It's somewhat new, and divorce lawyers aren't really paying much attention to that trend. People, I don't think, have catered to that group in terms of providing them with information and resources maybe more appropriate for their position in life. For example, division of assets, alimony, you know, the circumstances, situation changes when people are either already retired or close to retirement. The math is different from people that have, for example, young children, don't have a lot of retirement put away yet, et cetera.
Why do you think the numbers are on the upswing?
People are living long enough to and healthy long enough to see that maybe they want something else in their lives, that their relationship is no longer meeting their needs. And in the past, when people would die in their 60s, they weren't in a position where they thought a divorce was possible. They thought, well, I'll just stick with this because, frankly, it's not worth the expense and grief and effort. But now people are thinking, well, I might live to be 85 or older, and I'll be healthy longer. So people are looking inward, and they're deciding, maybe for this next chapter of my life, I need something different. And they think they have time and that it's okay to pay the expense necessary. They've made that cost-benefit analysis before. If your friends are all dying in their 60s, you figure, you know, why am I worrying about getting divorced at this point? And that is a radical change. It's only occurred in the last few decades.
What is different for those who are in the senior years as opposed to a more traditional divorce age?
They have concerns that are a little different. So usually we're not dealing with children. We have adult children. We have grandchildren that we're dealing with. We've got people concerned about now that either one or both people are retired. So the way that they're looking at asset division is very different. And concerns about alimony are different because of the way our law works. So for example, a reasonable retirement age for somebody in Illinois law is somewhere between 63, 64, and 67. I've done divorces where people are working, but they're older than that. So let's assume there's been a long-term marriage, 35, 40-year marriage, and somebody's working, making good income, and there's an order for maintenance, or what we call alimony in other states. Well, the person receiving that thinks, great, this person legally could retire tomorrow, and there's nothing I can do to stop it. So a maintenance award that might have looked good to somebody who's 35 or 40 years old looks pretty sketchy to somebody who's 75 years old and their husband or wife could retire at any moment, which changes the equation when you're looking at how to resolve a case.
What is the kind of advice you would give someone who is in a relationship that's ending and is near retirement?
So much depends on the circumstances. So there are a couple ways to look at it. If you're the person who might be paying maintenance and you can afford to retire, meaning you've got enough assets and you figure you don't need to work full time, then technically or theoretically it behooves you to retire before a divorce, because then it's a fait accompli and it's done and you won't be paying any maintenance if you're actually retired. I think people should, if they enjoy working, keep working. You know, this, there's a little too much emphasis, I think, sometimes on divorce planning, people tying themselves in knots in their lives to try to get an edge on their divorce, when let's assume you're paying support and it's something under a third of net income, which is how the formula works in Illinois. Wouldn't you rather make 2/3 of your net income and have that money at your disposal to invest in stuff rather than not making any? So that's something I talk to people who are normally going to be paying maintenance. They'll say, well, I want to quit my job so I don't have to pay maintenance. Well, you're kind of cutting off your nose to spite your face. So it's so important about to decide what your priorities are. But if your plan was to retire anyway, then there's no reason to wait. If you're not retired, that's the status quo from the court's perspective. And the lawyer on the other side, the lawyer for the soon to be ex, their perspective is, well, you're working, so you need to pay maintenance. Despite the fact the person says, I plan to retire next month or in 3 months, or 6 months or a year, they'll say, fine, then do that then. And we'll discuss it at that point. If you're a person who is the person making less income, I would urge that person to get some type of job that has health insurance, because health insurance is expensive. And after you get divorced, there's no guarantee your spouse will stay working. They can retire at any time. That means support might be terminated. Your maintenance gets terminated. And that's what was paying for your health insurance. And now you're burning through your retirement assets to pay for basic expenses. And that's not a good thing. So, because assume we're getting divorced at 65 or 60 to 75 years old, we've got a lot of life left to live and expenses to pay. So it's a quality of life issue. And you don't have to work very hard to get a job that pays for health insurance. There are part-time employment at major companies, part-time jobs, where they'll provide health insurance. And that's just gold these days. Either keep working to maintain your health insurance and have something to do. You don't have to kill yourself, but keep working and generate that income, because it doesn't reduce maintenance very much. And it provides a safety cushion in the event your soon-to-be ex retires, gets ill, gets let go. And there are a lot of things beyond that person's control. A court order that says they're supposed to pay maintenance is just a piece of paper.
What is the most common age or situation for people to split?
You have what you kind of call the starter marriages. These are people married between 3-5 years and things just don't work out. They might have a young child or they have no kids and they get divorced. There's the folks that are in the middle area we see probably the most of, and these are people who've been married 15, 20 years. They have a couple kids, usually a kid in high school and maybe in grade school, or somebody in college and somebody in high school. And they're in their 40s, something like that, somewhere between 35 and 50 years old. And then the third group are the I guess you'd say the gray divorce people, but that's a pretty wide range these days. I've seen people anywhere from, let's say, 60 in their 60s to in their 70s. And the usual hallmarks of that are the children are fully launched. Everybody has time to focus inward again. The nest is truly empty. And one of the two people says to themselves, is this all there is? And they see a lot of life left ahead of them. Now the kids are gone, they're grown, and they finally have come to the point where their cost-benefit analysis tips toward they're deciding that the divorce is worth the gamble.
Is there a scenario where it is more difficult to reach an agreement if people have similar incomes?
It tends to be more difficult if one person isn't working and they're looking to receive support. If they're close in incomes, it's a lot easier because there's no alimony and it's just a division of assets and debt situation. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's definitely less complex. If both people are working, they're less concerned about their own financial situations because they're paying the bills with their own incomes and they've got health insurance. So those cases tend to be easier. The trickier ones are ones where one person is not working, or maybe they have medical challenges and can't earn an income, or it's a very small income relative to the other party. Because I like that issue I raised before, where it's one thing if the person was going to work another 20 years, or spousal support court order that says they're going to pay you indefinitely, which is what, if you've been married over 20 years in Illinois, that's what the court orders, assuming the income is there. If somebody's looking at being supported for another 20 years, they're not concerned. But in a situation of a gray divorce where somebody's retired or unable to work or only able to earn a small income, they're very worried that even if they get that maintenance order, the person could die, get sick, get fired, or quit. And the court will allow them to quit it after they're 65-ish years old and they can terminate maintenance then. So that leaves them burning through assets. And a lot of folks, you know, in our market, more people have, you know, substantial assets, but broadly, a lot of people in the baby boom generation have not saved, or they haven't saved what they really need for retirement. You know, any wealth manager will tell you that. And that leaves people in a precarious position, you know, relying on Medicare, Social Security, and things of that nature.
That's divorce attorney Rafer Dalton Palmer, author of the bestseller, I Just Want This Done, discussing the latest trends in divorce. He spoke with Maureen McKinney. Food deserts have grown across the rural Midwest, largely due to the disappearance of independent grocery stores. To push back against the trend, more states have created grant programs to support small grocers. As Harvest Public Media's Rachel Kramer reports, the stores are part of the backbone of many rural communities.
In the back room at Wood Supermarket in Delhi, Kent Wood and his son pull the plastic away from a pallet stacked with boxes. One contains bottles of ketchup, others hold canned soup and pasta.
04512.
While unloading, they call out numbers printed on each box to check off inventory.
And then a 21.
On truck delivery days, Kent gets here at 4:30 a.m.
I wouldn't come to work and work as many hours as I do if I didn't like it.
Wood Supermarket in Delhi sits in front of a grain elevator in Pocahontas, a town of about 1,800 people in northwest Iowa. While a few dollar stores sell food, this is the only grocery store in town. Kent's wife and store co-owner, Kim Wood, says the closest alternatives are outside the county lines, about 20 to 30 minutes away.
Yeah, the elderly population, especially in the wintertime, they don't want to drive out of town to get groceries, and I think that would be a hardship.
Rural policy experts say grocery stores are vital for communities to thrive, but the number of rural independent grocery stores in the U.S. has steadily declined in recent decades. To help reverse this trend, half a dozen states, including Illinois, Minnesota, North Dakota, and Oklahoma, have passed legislation in recent years to develop grant programs for grocers. Now, lawmakers in Iowa and Nebraska are pushing to create their own versions. Jillian Linster is the Senior Director of Policy at the Center for Rural Affairs. The organization is advocating for both bills.
Our staff live and work in the communities that we serve. And so we were seeing in our everyday lives that more and more stores were closing or struggling to stay open.
A recent study found the number of rural independent grocery stores in Nebraska declined by 30% from 2016 to 2021.
Rural independent grocers are operating on extremely slim profit margins, sometimes as little as 1%.
Competition with dollar stores and supercenters in the region are one of the biggest challenges for independent grocers. Fewer customers from population loss, rising operating costs, and aging equipment are also factors. Chad Engels is one of the Republican representatives who introduced the Grocer Reinvestment Bill in Iowa. During a noisy subcommittee meeting, he said a grant program could make a big difference for mom-and-pop grocery stores.
And I hear from all of them, we're just one freezer breakdown, one cooler breakdown from shutting the door.
While the Nebraska and Iowa bills are slightly different, they both aim to help rural independent grocers pay for things like new equipment and utility upgrades. Funds from the Nebraska program could also be used to explore new business models, like purchasing cooperatives. This is something Liz Ravenscroft says she wants to explore if the grant program gets off the ground.
The problem with our remote location is we are unable to sell a minimum amount that certain companies require for groceries.
She manages Circle C Market, a nonprofit grocery store affiliated with a school in Cody, Nebraska. Population, 170. Ravenscroft says some of their customers come from an hour away to buy milk, bread, and other essentials. By creating a purchasing cooperative with other retailers in north central Nebraska, Ravenscroft says they could order directly from a wholesaler and pass savings on to customers.
You know, we're always looking for ways to get groceries at a more affordable cost for our customers. That's the bottom line.
Ravenscroft, also a full-time business teacher, says managing Circle C Market requires a lot of time. But it's a labor of love. She wants to support her community. In the break room at Woods Supermarket and Deli in Pocahontas, Kent and Kim Woods say the same thing. Many of their customers are people they've known for decades. When one had a health issue recently, they helped out by delivering her groceries.
I mean, that's what you do in a small town. You look out for each other. No.
Rural advocates in Iowa and Nebraska say it makes sense for states to look after small-town grocers in return. I'm Rachel Kramer, Harvest Public Media.
That's all the time we have for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Be with us again next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois public radio stations.